Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Lisa and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this faith. So I met David last year at a retreat. I missed the story, but I did get to talk to him a couple of times, and he's this really super cool, awesome guy. And so I get to dig.
Okay, my name's David. I'm an alcoholic. That's funny you guys read that. That was actually something I was going to read out of the book. All right, because normally we read how it works, and you hear people say this when they tell their stories that, our stories disclose in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I really like that other reading on page 29, right? How I use my own words, my own language to describe the awakening process, okay? And for whatever reason, I got to listen to my heart, and I feel led to open in some form of just a minor meditation, okay? And I'm going to do it because when I first found a message that I could hear clearly, it was in Buckhead, right? And it was a group of guys, and whenever they got together, the first thing they did was meditate, okay? And then they opened in prayer. Meditation and prayer. And I got introduced to step 11 right off the bat. And I wrote this prayer out in the Aldi's parking lot over here. And it's a collaboration of prayers. Whenever I hear something that speaks to me, I write it down. Whenever I read something in a book and it speaks to me, I write it down. And I just strung it together. And it comes from all kinds of different places. So, if you guys could do me a favor, and everybody lean forward in your chair, please. And then slide your butts back, and now you'll have a straight spine against the back of your chair. Okay? Just bear with me. I know this is going to be silly for some of you, maybe all of you, I don't know. But this is what I feel like I'm supposed to do. So, okay, everybody, let's close our eyes for a second, please. And we're going to focus on our breathing. We're going to breathe in. Nice and slow. We're going to pause for a second. We're going to breathe out nice and slow. We're going to relax and take it easy. We're going to relax and take it easy. And now we're all going to remember a time in our lives when we were eager to learn something. Something new that interested us. Something that we wanted to gain in life. Maybe it was learning how to play the guitar, or learning how to sew, or fixing your truck, or whatever the case may be. We were eager to learn. Now remember the attitude that you had when you approached the subject that you were eager to find. You had questions. You inquired. You looked. You searched. You did research and development to try to learn. When you found someone that was on this path, you asked them lots of questions. You didn't argue because you didn't know. This is the attitude, I think. In step 11, in the big book, it says, if we work at it with the right attitude, we can achieve it. We can gain access. So with this attitude of open-mindedness, this attitude of seeking without argument, without question, we're going to return to our breath. I'm going to pray. Spirit of the universe, we thank you for the opportunity to gather in harmony and to seek you collectively. We see these simple yet profound acts as an outpouring of your love and grace. We see that we are praying through you as much as we are praying to you. And we thank you for the ability to contact you through consciousness. Spirit, we acknowledge the fact that we spend so much time trying to gain the approval and validation of others. We recognize its presence even in sobriety and even in the fellowship. Please show us how to stop counting and comparing. Please test our beliefs that cause us to defend and separate ourselves from one another. Allow us to be okay with not knowing and not having all the answers. We know that we find you not in perfection, but only through our imperfections. So please take away our desire to be seen as perfect. Let our egos bear the humiliation of waking up to the truth that we are not actually in control. Please give us the strength to humbly ask for help. Remove our desires to climb to the top, to be seen and to be glorified. Disturb us with the truth that we are just like everyone else, even those we despise. Give us the strength to step down and become small and anonymous like your subtle presence. Please lift us out of the illusion of being separate. Please heal our perception that we may know only reality and only you. Your will, not ours. Amen. All right, thank you guys. Okay, so I'm going to talk about my story. But my story, when I first came in, I was consumed with this fact that it was all about me, right? And it wasn't until I heard somebody else tell their story that I began to identify and realize that I was not the only one. And then we read Bill's story. And what I realized in Bill's story is that I was very much like this rich white guy from the 1930s, and I could not believe it. Could not believe it, that he had the same difficulties internally within. And this whole process to me, when we talk about, in our own words, how we come to find God, what I'm really saying is how I come to find an awakening. All right? And in order to talk about an awakening, I have to talk about what it means to be unawake. Unawake. Which is the state I'm in when I come into this. All right? Also known in step one as unmanageability. Unmanageability. And so, I want to start off in the middle of my story, all right, the story I have been given to tell. And it starts off in the basement of 8111 in 2014, okay? I had just relapsed after 11 months of sobriety. I left the meeting, a noon meeting, and I got high. And I sat in the basement of this clubhouse across from my sponsor. And this man, after 3 minutes of meditation, he prayed a set-aside prayer, and he opened his eyes, and he looked at me. And he said, "For some reason during meditation, I felt led to ask you this question. And I know at the beginning of this process, when we first got together and started working, I told you that I would not do anything outside of the first 164 pages of the big book. That we were going to do I was going to take you through the work. We're going to do exactly what it says. Nothing less. Nothing more. But I really feel compelled to do this one thing. Are you okay with that?" And this is what came out of my mouth. Right, and I see this today as the voice of God, because what I said is, "I have nowhere else to go and nothing else to do. I'm willing to do anything. Just tell me what you think I should do." And that was a gift for me, because up until that point, I had ideas about everything and I thought I could figure it all out. Right, and this is what Kevin said to me. He said, "I want you to think about that girl that you talk about all the time. Right, the one that left you because you wouldn't stop shooting dope. The one that started sleeping with your coworker. I want you to close your eyes and think about that whole situation." And that's what I did. I closed my eyes and I began to think about that. And he said, "I don't want you to think about them. I want you to think about the feeling that it gives you." And I started to get this knot in my stomach. I was a very, very angry individual at that moment. Really, my whole life up to that. I started to get really angry. My ears started to burn. I started to, bite down on my teeth. And he said, "Okay, now I want you to think about, don't think about them. Let me know when you have the feeling." And I said, "I'm there." He said, "I want you to think about the first time you ever felt that. Open your eyes when you know it." And I instantly opened my eyes. I opened my eyes and I looked at him and he said, "Who is it? Where is it? Where is it?" And I said, "It's towards my mother. It's my first memory." I don't know why, but it's towards my mom. Okay? That moment right there, he said, okay, we're going to do inventory on your mother. Right? And for the next 30 years, okay, I could not really remember why I was angry at my mom. I didn't know why. And it wasn't until this past year, I swear to God, I'm driving down the road. Okay? Driving down the road with the windows down, listening to music, in a state of peace. And these memories of my childhood come back. Okay? And I want to share that with you guys. Because this is where unmanageability begins for me. Okay? My life was not unmanageable because I started drinking and drugging. My life was unmanageable from the get-go a long time ago. And this is what happened. I was raised in New York City. Okay? I was raised by fundamentalist evangelicals who believed that the end was near at any time, the rapture was coming, that the Bible was the written word of God, and if anything was not in the Bible, it was not truth. Okay? This is what I was raised to believe. And I was homeschooled. And my mother got together with other little homeschool families. Okay, and I was raised without any secular music, without any television, without being able to go to the movies. This was my upbringing. This is what I was told in my formative years. These things are of the devil, of the world, and you can't have anything to do with that. Okay, but when I saw my cousins and when I saw all the other kids, even kids at church, they got to have Nintendo. They got to watch Full House. They knew about Ren and Stimpy, and I didn't have any of that shit when I was a kid. Right, and so my dad came home one day with this. This device, all right, and it was an educational type game that you could play, some kind of educational game, and to me it was like Nintendo, right, and I got to play this thing, and there was another kid there, and out of nowhere he snatched the controller from me, and I was trying to tell him how to do something, and he slammed me on the ground, and he knocked the breath out of me. And at the time, I'd never had the breath knocked on me. I thought I was dying, right? And I started screaming and crying, and I ran into the other room to get my mother, to let her know what this kid had done. And my mother turned around, and she got down, and she looked at me, or she pulled me into the other room, and she said, "Stop acting like this. You're embarrassing me." And I could not believe that my mother was doing this to me. I couldn't believe it. And I went to my room. I went to my room. And I went inside to the secret place, right, into my consciousness. And I said this little thing to God. This is also my first prayer. Okay? Why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? I cannot believe that this is life. Okay? And I birthed, that day, I birthed my greatest stage character called the role of the victim. Okay, I would play the role of the victim in everything I did from that point. And when I came out of the room, my mother had despised this thing because she thought it was Nintendo 2, and she gave it to this kid. And something in my heart shriveled up that day. Okay, and I can't really remember. I didn't remember this for a long time, but my father would say things to me through my upbringing. "Why are you acting this way? What's going on?" And I would say, "I don't know. I don't know." And in my little head, in my little heart, I felt so betrayed and abandoned and separate from. Okay? And this is where unmanageability begins for me. And so I'm in New York City at the time. My dad gets burned out on the city and he wants to get us out of there. So we move to the mountains of Virginia, to where his parents are. And it was a culture shock. Everybody's white, everybody's redneck. You know, I come from the South Bronx and I come from being homeschooled on top of it by fundamentalists and put into public school. And I identify very differently from everybody else. Okay, and it's very challenging for me. And again, I tell myself the same thing: why is this happening to me? Why am I different from everyone? Why can't I be like everyone else? Okay, that is the theme of my life, the pattern that this cycle in my head, where I'm constantly comparing myself to other people. All right. So around this time, at the age of 11. My parents, okay, they told me about the rapture, and they allowed us to watch these movies about the rapture, which were horrible. That, you know, people, your loved ones are just vanished and taken away, right? And this was my greatest fear. my greatest fear, because I knew deep down in my heart that something was not right with me. And this is how I felt, and I was afraid that everyone I loved, my family, was going to be taken away at any moment. Right? And I was told that God is love and God is forgiveness, and that redemption was for all, yet I did not feel this in my heart. And I would pray this sinner's prayer 3 times a week because I was forced to go to church, because I thought at any moment I'd get hit by a car and I'd burn in a lake of fire. Okay? And today I see this consciousness of being an unmanageability as the living hell that I'm in, that we're in as alcoholics and drug addicts. Right? So it's my parents tell me, they keep me out of sex ed and they won't let me talk about or have anything to do with sex or anything like that. Right? And there's this girl in our church in New York City. One of my last memories is this girl, the preacher's daughter, she got knocked up. And what they did was make this girl come down in front of the church, get in front of the microphone, and confess her sins. Okay? And I was horrified for that. Even as a child, she was weeping on stage. It was horrible. Right? And I knew that in my parents' mind that sexual sin is the greatest abomination in the world. Okay? There's nothing worse than that. God will forgive you. It seemed like in my mind, God will forgive you for all this stuff, but not for sexual sin. So when I'm 11 years old, I'm touched on the school. I get touched on the school bus. Okay? And I don't tell a soul because I'm terrified that my father, he's going to march me into school or march me in front of the church. And I feel this shame and humiliation. Okay? And I tell all you guys this stuff because what she read on page 29, right? It's in fully disclosing these secrets of my childhood that I would never tell another soul. Okay? This is the stuff that I was going to take to my grave. You don't need to hear this. You don't, because then if you know this about me, you won't like me. Right? So I'm putting on this mask all the time. Right? And this is how I live my life. Right? At age 11, I'm already putting on this mask. I'm miserable and angry. Right? I have a feeling of uselessness. I'm full of fear. I can't seem to get anything right. I'm terrified. This is how it stayed until I found weed in the beginning. Right? I find weed. And in that beginning, in that moment, I'll tell you what happened. I used to think that it was the fear of not being good enough, right, that drove everything I did. Now, I'm not good enough. I'm worthless. That's why my mother abandoned me. Right? That's why I got molested. That's why all this stuff happened. Right? But today I really believe, and Chuck C talks about this in a new pair of glasses, that really there is one problem. I'm separated from God. And when I'm separated from God, when I'm separated from the awakening, right, I'm separated from all of you. And I'm separated from myself. That's it. That's the only problem. And what happened when I used, when I first put the substance in my body, is that I became connected instantly. Okay? I became a part of, which is all I've ever wanted. I wanted to be a part of. I wanted to be like you guys. I wanted to be like all the other normal kids. Right? And the moment I put that substance in me, the fear vanished. Right? I became useful. I had something to look forward to. Right? And nothing up to that point had relieved the unmanageability in my heart. Nothing. I'd been to church, I'd said the prayer, I've hung out with people, and nothing seemed to fix me the way the substance did. Okay? And so I did what any human being would do. Right? I went to the thing that cured the problem deep inside me. The thing that I couldn't even put into words. Okay? And this would become a working part of my life. And I had to hide this from my parents. Obviously. Clearly. But when I was, I think, 16 or 17 years old, I found this a pharmaceutical in Oxycontin. And I was buying it off this kid. And he said, "You want to buy some of these other pills?" And I said, "Well, what are they?" And he said, "I don't know, but they were in the safe with my dad. So, in the safe with my dad's gun and the rest of these pills. So, they got to be good." And I was like, "Nah, I'm good, man." He's like, "Well, you can just have two. I got a whole bottle." And a few days later, I ate those. And I was driving with my dad down the road. I was riding in the passenger seat to go see my sister run regionals. She was a phenomenal student and athlete and a professional runner. And we were going to see her run. And I began to puke on myself and was not responding, and I was overdosing in the seat driving down I-81. And my father had no clue that his little boy, his oldest son, was a drug addict. And this is how he found out. And my father lost his mind when he realized what was going on. He tried to take me to the hospital, and they couldn't pump my stomach because of some other injuries before me. And my father, man, he is today, I recognize, one of the most sinful human beings I know, right? And it is because of his faith in his higher power, and I have to say it that way, right? My father said, God's will be done, and he went to the race, okay? But when I came to, my father, the only time I've ever seen my father lose his shit was towards me or my brother. It was over drugs or alcohol. And my father beat me. This is what my brother tells me. I don't even remember this till I told him the name of the kid I got the stuff from. Okay? And then he did exactly what my worst fear was. He marched me into the school. He told the principal. They pulled me out of the public school system. And they homeschooled me my junior year. And I returned to the same thing. Why is this happening to me? Why did you place me here? Why are these my parents? And this third step concept, okay, the third step concept began to take root in my consciousness. And it was this: if I can get away from my parents, if I can get away from this upbringing, if I can get and be on my own and do the things that I want to do, I will be okay. Okay, this became a working part of my mind. If I wasn't doing dope, I was thinking about how I can turn 18 and I'm gone. You'll never see me again. I hated them. I hated them for what they did to me. And this is how I lived. Right? And my parents homeschooled me. They allowed me to go back to my senior year. And I went right back to the thing that gave me peace. Instinctively. Even though it had caused all this chaos, I didn't learn anything because none of that fixes me on the inside, man. And this whole process is about one thing and one thing alone. It's about the interior life. Okay? It's about how I see myself, how I see you. It's about my attitude. Okay? Dope fixes that instantly for me. Until it doesn't. It doesn't. And so, I did exactly what I said at 18 years old. I came home drunk, and my dad said, "You're out. You're an adult. You want a drink? That's fine. Peace." And he threw me out. And I slept in a Saturn station wagon. Alright? And I slept on couches. And I started to drink very heavily. And I noticed very early on, I had a very abnormal reaction to my friends. They all thought it was funny. And I tried to laugh it off as funny. But when I drank, something very strange happened to me. I would remember up until a point, and then I would not remember anything, and then people would have to tell me, "Dude, you broke the coffee table, then you stole the bottle of liquor from that girl, you hid yourself in the closet, you drank the whole thing, and you came out naked and puked everywhere." Or whatever. And they would tell me this would happen. I would be horrified. "Are you kidding me? I did that?" No. And it was horrible. And I would play the tape through. Why did I do that? Why did I do that? Why would I do something like that? I didn't want to do that. I was trying to hook up with the girl. Why would you do something like that? She didn't want anything to do with me ever again. And I would notice that this happened often. Alright? And so I began to realize, okay, liquor, this is what I started to think. Liquor's the problem. It's got to be the liquor. Alright? I'm going to stick to beer. And I noticed that the same type of phenomenon of craving would occur. I would drink beer up until a point, and then there would be a bottle of liquor there, and I could not say no. And then I would drink the whole thing, and I would do the same thing again. Right? And I would also, I'm one of those guys, man, I would get in the car and go. I'm a drunk driving fool, man. That's what I do. I know if I start drinking right now, I would get my, I don't know why. It's just what I do. And I got my first DUI. Okay? I got my first DUI. Did not wake up. Did not change me. The punishment from the law does not change my consciousness, doesn't wake me up, and I go back to the same thing over and over again. Right? And all of this keeps continuing, and through this whole period, I go to school. I'm in college, and I'm working at the power company in my local town. And I'm a good worker. because I grew up on free lunch. I grew up dirt poor because my father gave his life to ministry. Right? To this day, my parents own a gospel bookstore in the hills of Virginia. How they make a living, how he raised three kids on that, I do not know. He barely did. He barely did. And that was the other thing I was so resentful at. My father is a very, very intelligent man. He can take anything apart and put it back together. And I said, why are you doing this? You know, I had to eat free lunch. I was so ashamed of that. I was on Medicaid. I was so ashamed of that shit when I was a kid. Why are you doing this? And he would say, because God told me to, son. This is what I have to do. This is my path. And I thought, man, you are an idiot. You are an idiot. Why are you doing this to us? And I understand what he was saying today. Right? I've come full circle. I get it. And so I was obsessed that money would fix me. Okay? Money, get away from my parents, get out of this hometown that I'm in the mountains of Virginia. That's it. If I can do those things, I will be happy and satisfied. And that was my theory, and I believed it with everything in me. And so that's what I did. Right? But before I did, I'm going to talk about, I know this is AA, but my story includes dope, right? My master is the needle. That's how I ended up here, okay? And alcohol is part of my story, too. I'm certainly an alcoholic, right? But my experience with alcohol in that period, right, is that I could drink all night, I could drink till 4 or 5 in the morning, pass out, the alarm would go off at 6, and I'd get up and drive drunk to work till noon and start my hangover. Okay, I did that. I did the same thing with school. I did it for a long time, for years. Right, but when I was introduced to the needle, to slamming morphine sulfate and Oxycontin, something very different happened. Okay, the phenomenon of craving for me, when it comes to that stuff, it took me. Okay, and when I say it took me, I mean I became unemployable. I was flunking out of school. The girl I was in love with left me. My family didn't want anything to do with me. I lost my driver's license. I became homeless for real. I became a lone wolf. Even the people I shot dope with and drank with said, dude, you're too much. You're too much. I became an unwanted clinger-onner, like in Bill's story. I would call my friends, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? Can I, you know? They're like, dude, you're just trying to score off my back. You're trying to get my dope, or you're using me. This is what I became. And the baffling thing about it is I did not realize it until I ran out of money. Okay, when I ran out of money and I realized where I was, all right, that I began to think back on what had happened. Okay, I was introduced to this thing. I did it, and it fixed me. Like, okay, even when I drank, I was still fearful a lot often, but when I put opiates in my body, I was invincible. Okay, that's what it did for me. It made me feel complete and whole in a way that I cannot express. All right, it was a mystical experience. And so when this happened to me, and I realized that I was getting taken by this thing, I realized that I had a problem. Clearly, I had a problem. I'd spent all my money. I'd spent all my relationships, I ended up alone. Okay? And so, it was during this time I found, I took a film appreciation course in my hometown, and that little girl I was in love with back then, she found this community college in Charleston, South Carolina. She's a true codependent, man. She would do anything for me back then. And I manipulated her to death. Right? She put me in a car with no money, with nothing, and she drove me to Charleston, South Carolina. She put me in film school, okay? Because I became convinced if I could work in film, I could get out of town, then I'd be whole, right? And I did all that stuff, okay? And it was my idea then that I am not going to shoot dope. I'm going to work in the film industry, and I'm going to drink like a gentleman, okay? But if you're like me, and that was I knew I couldn't do it. I was going to burn it to the ground. I excelled very quickly in film school. I did 2 semesters. I was older than a lot of the kids, and I had a work ethic of a poor person. Some of y'all know what I'm talking about. Get up and work because there's no other option, right? And so I excelled, and I got into the film industry. I got into the union very quickly, and this became my drug of choice then, right? I was drinking and socializing, but in the back of me, in the back of my mind, deep in my heart, I still felt separated. I still didn't feel like I was truly a part of, right? No matter what I did. Even though people would say, man, you're so good at this. You're such a great technician. Like, blah, blah. It didn't fix me. It didn't cure this thing deep down in my heart, right? It didn't. And so I would drink and pretend like I was normal, but every time I went home for Christmas or Thanksgiving to see my family, I spent very little time with my family, and I'd go over to the trailer park, and you all know what I did. I felt whole again. I had to. And I looked forward more than anything in the world to these little moments where I could go feel complete and unity and whole, where the fear would go away. Right? I lived for these moments. Right? And before I know it, I would cheat on that little girl, and she found out, right? And she left me. That time it was done. I drug her through the mud for years, and this time she left me. And I quickly found heroin in Charleston, it's a port town. Okay? And I knew real quick, I told myself, the one thing, I'll never get high on set. That's the one thing I'll never do. I'll never do. And what did I do that first week? I'm doing it. Okay? And I went to school with this kid in Charleston, and he moved to Atlanta, and he started working in the film industry here. And I called him up. I was terrified to talk to people on the phone, but I knew I had to do something. I was about to burn my career to the ground. I worked so hard to get here. So I called this kid up and said, yo, what's going on in Atlanta? What's it looking like? He's like, yo, it's slamming. Come down. I got a spot for you, like, tomorrow if you want. And so that's what I did. So I leave it alone, put it down again, come to Atlanta. I moved to East Atlanta Village. Okay. I know this. If I'm not putting a needle in my arm, I have to be able to stagger home from the bar. I have to. There's no other way. I can't function. I can't live inside my head in a state of sobriety. Like, some of y'all know what I'm talking about. There was nothing more horrible in the whole world than to be sober, right, without a solution that does what dope does. Nothing. I mean, I understand why people off themselves. I really do. I have compassion for them because it's horrible. It's horrible. It's the emptiest feeling in the world to have a medicine and then have the medicine removed. Especially when you can see someone else doing it. Right? I could not do it. I could not do it. I could not watch another person drink. I could not watch another person get high on opiates without having it myself. So, I moved to East Atlanta Village so I can stagger back and forth so I don't get another DUI. And even then, I still drive drunk. I have multiple DUIs at this point. Multiple arrests for public intoxication. And I have to do it. It's part of my life. And I tell myself this thing that, like, this is just who I am. This is what I was created to be. If you don't like it, you know, fuck off. You know, I got my life. You got yours. Do whatever you want. Right? And I'm arrogant. I'm so arrogant. I'm so proud. And I think that I got it all figured out. And so about that time, my neighbor happened to be this weirdo artist guy, and it didn't take long for me to find dope here. And I started dabbling in it, and I knew what I was doing. And at the same time, I was establishing myself in Atlanta as a very good technician, and my phone was ringing off the hook. People wanted to work with me, right? And I started working on all these big Hollywood movies as a lighting technician, and I was so full of myself. And I thought, just like in Bill's story, I have arrived. I made it. Look at me now. The kid on free lunch. The kid grew up with nothing. Look at this. I bought a house in East Atlanta Village. I started dating this little girl. All right, she was a technician, too. She's the one I started with in the beginning of my story. All right, I fall in love with this girl. And about that time, I got a dog. And I took this dog home to Virginia, because I was working an out-of-town job in Alabama. And my mom called me one day, and she said, your dog didn't come home today. And I love that dog. For the longest part of my life, man, and still to this day, when I'm having trouble connecting with people, when I can't connect to people, I can find love in an animal. I don't know why it is, and that's been my whole life, man. My home was a chaos. My little dogs, they gave me the sense of compassion and love, unconditional love. And my mom told me that dog was gone. And I said the same thing I said when I was a kid. Why did you do this to me? Look at what you've done. I hate you. And I used that as a reason. To go get $100 worth of dope. Okay, $100 worth of dope is the same as drinking four beers. for me. If I drink four beers, I am not stopping until I black out. If I shoot $100 of dope and take it for 2.5-3 days, done. Done. Empty the bank account. Lose the job, lose the girl, lose it all. That's what happened. Okay? And when I come out of this thing, I can't believe. Same thing. I'm full of shame. I embarrassed myself. I'd show up to work trying to unload a truck, bleeding out of the arm. My friends are like, dude, what are you doing? You need help. And I refuse to do it. I refuse to ask for help. I refuse to spend my money and go to rehab. That's what I thought, it was a scam. I can figure this out. I can do this. I can stop, right? And in the end, I wake up to the truth. I wake up alone again. And nobody wants anything to do with me. And this is a gift. This is a gift. And this is where I realize, okay, I got to do something different. I realize this. And I start going to meetings. And I think this is the solution. I'm going to go to meetings. I'm going to become one of these meeting makers. And I go in there, and it's real strange. Like, I don't, you know, I think you guys are a cult. I think you guys are weird. And I stop doing it, right? And I start drinking again. I start drinking heavily. And I'm trying not to shoot dope anymore. And I was just trying to drink, and I'm trying to work, and my drinking at this point takes a real nasty turn. And I black out on the clock on set, okay? And thankfully I'm with my friends, and they carry me, man, they carry me. So grateful for these dudes. And I wake up to the truth that this is, I'm doing it again. And beyond that, every other time I get drunk, I go out and shoot cocaine now, or whatever the case may be. And I realize something is wrong. Okay, and I know I have to do something, but I don't know what to do. So I take a trip to Denver, Colorado to go visit my sister, because I think now I blame Atlanta the same way. Atlanta is the problem. The film industry is the problem. The girl's the problem. And I go to Atlanta. I go to Denver. It's 11 o'clock in the morning and I'm drinking. Okay, drinking down in the basement of a bar. And I look over, I remember I pissed off this side of the bar, and I looked over at this guy. There was a businessman sitting next to me. He was cutting a steak. And I said, are you drinking a Long Island iced tea? And he said, no, man, I'm drinking a sweet tea. And I said, what kind of pussy sits at the bar and doesn't drink? So I said to this guy, and he said, I remember what it was like when I could not watch a man, when I didn't have a drink in my hand and another man was drinking next to me. I remember how horrible that feeling was. Thank God I don't have to live like that today. And I wiped the smile off my face because I realized that this man had just described the obsession of the mind in his own words, in his own way. The thing that I tried to explain to all the girls I'd fallen in love with and my family, I didn't know how to express it. He said it so clearly and so calmly. And I knew this man had what I had by the way he described it. And except he went back to cutting his steak. He wasn't lying my drink or worried that he was there. And this one thing came out of my mouth. And this was the moment where I stopped having ideas. And I had one thing to say, and it was a question. Okay? And I said, how the fuck are you sitting here? How are you capable of doing this? And this man, he said, I worked the 12 steps and I got free. That's all he said. And so I came back to Atlanta and I knew there was something in AA. I knew there was something in the 12 steps, and I went to meetings all the time. Okay? I went to meetings all the time, but I did not work the steps. I became part of this fellowship. And I shaved my head and I started dressing differently. And I went back to school and I stopped working on features and I started working on commercials. I changed everything on the outside and I told everybody I was in recovery. And I thought that I was. Okay? But all that shit from my childhood, all that shit buried deep within me that I don't know how to express to you guys, it's still buried. It's still there. Right? And that comes up to that point where I went home for Christmas at 11 months. I went to the noon meeting and I went by my buddy's house, right? Down on the bad side of town. And I saw my friend and I thought I'd tell him about recovery. And this is where I did exactly the thing that I didn't want to do. I got high. And I was baffled by it. I had a chip in my pocket. How did I do this? Okay? So I come back to Atlanta and my sponsor tells me that. This is back to the beginning. He says,
Where did that feeling originate from? It's towards my mother. It's towards my mother. Okay? And Kevin sits down with me and he does inventory on my mom. He shows me the process. And I blamed my mother for everything, and I hated her, and I cussed her out, and I was ashamed of her ethnicity and her origin. She's from Trinidad, from an island in the Caribbean. Her ancestors were slaves to the British Empire, right? Making sugar, sending sugar back to Britain. I was so ashamed of that. And I look down, and I get to the fourth column, and I realize, I look at what I've done to my mother. How I blamed her for all of this. How I shamed her publicly. Right? How I hated her. I told her that she was worthless. And I see that how I've hurt my mom. And then Kevin says, what kind of upbringing did your mother have? When she responded like this. And I look at my mom's life, and I've known this, but I've never really looked. My mother was raised on this island. In a school where she was put in the back of the classroom, she couldn't see the board. And because she couldn't see the board, they told her that she was stupid. And then back then and in that country, they made her wear a dunce hat and stand in the corner, and everybody ridiculed her. And then they beat her. And then when she went home, my mom's siblings told my grandparents, and they beat her again. Okay? And I began to see very clearly that my mother... Of course my mother was worried about being embarrassed. That's all she knew. And something inside of me began to blossom, and it was called compassion and understanding. Right? I got to see my mother for who she was. And I realized, like, she was doing the best she could with what she had. That's what she was doing. She had no other option. Right? So Kevin says, this is good stuff, man. I want you to go home and sit with this for an hour. Look at your character defects. And I went home, and he said, call me when you're done. I went home and did it. Then he said, call me when you're done. I called him up. He said, I want you to pray the 7-step prayer. I said, okay. I did it. And he said, all right, we have a list of your harms, how you hurt your mother in step 4. If you were going to make amends to your mom, I want you to write it out and call me back when it's done. This is all on the same day. And I did it. I did it because I didn't know what else to do. And he told me this because I called him again and he said, okay, read it to me. And I read it. And he said, that sounds pretty good, but don't say this because that's going to make her ask questions. And don't say this because that's hurtful. Say this. And then he said, I want you to meditate for a few minutes and I want you to call your mother and make the amends. And I said, there's no way in hell I can't do that, man. I cannot do that. I cannot face my mother with this, with who I really am. And he said, there's no other way. This is the thing you've been running from your whole life. Okay? This is step 9. This is the thing you must do. You understand? He said, you shot dope 3 days ago. You're not going to make it, kid. You said you were willing to go to any length just moments ago. This is it. This is what any length looks like. Call your mom and make the amends. And that's what I did. I picked up the phone and he told me, he said, I want you to start it off by saying, Mom, I love you. Which is the only time I could tell my mother I loved her is when I was drunk or high. That's the only time I could express it. Right? And when I said, Mom, I love you, I cried so hard. And this thing inside of me broke free that day. Okay? It did. I was able to face my mother. I was able to admit how I was wrong. And my mother did the same thing in response. Because love had found her heart and my heart through this process. Okay, going to meetings did not do that for me. I had to have an experience. Alright? And from that, I wish I could tell you that that was it. I was good. But you know what? That little girl that slept with my coworker, I wouldn't make that amends for 2 more years. And how I did not get high, I do not know. But I was sick. I became miserable. Miserable. Right? Because I wouldn't do it. I tried to ride on that, on the high from all the other amends. And I had some very powerful amends, but I wouldn't do it. And eventually, I had to face it. I had to do it. Right? I had to go down this list because I would get restless, irritable, and discontent again. And I can do it in sobriety. Right? I can do it in sobriety. I can fall asleep to this truth, to this compassion, to this selflessness that is necessary for me to remain at peace And when I'm at peace, I do not have the desire to drink or drug. Right? And this process has been amazing. And the past year, I left Atlanta a year ago. And when do I stop? 5 till or what?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. I just want to share a couple of things about this past year, about this change in consciousness that has taken over me, and the growth that has occurred. My sobriety, I didn't say it, but my sobriety date is 12/25/14, right? So 7 years. I've experienced more growth in the last year and a half, 2 years, than in the first 5 years altogether, right? Because of my sponsor in Virginia, the first thing he did was give me a book on meditation, okay? And I have fallen deep into meditation and into the prayer life, into seeking. This is a great capsule, but there's so much more out there. All right, and I can do them together, and it's amazing. And when I was a kid, I told myself, I will never, ever have kids. All right, when I was in that unmanageable mind, I said, how could you bring a kid into this world? This is a horrible, evil place. I'll never, ever do that. Right, and then I've read this meditation book this past year, man, and it was by Anthony DeMello, and it was on the teaching of Saint Ignatius, who's the guy that founded the Jesuits. I know it's a bunch of nonsense, but this guy, okay, he said, take the thing that you fear the most and then pray and ask God for it to be manifested in your life. Not so that it will, so that you can lose your attachment. Okay? That's profound. And I've been dancing around with this thing in this past year. I said, if it better serves love and humility, then make me a father. All right, make me a father of some children. And I prayed that from my heart, which is the most horrible, terrifying thing I could ever pray in my entire life. That's the last thing I want, because I know I have to give up my weight. All right? And so I prayed that. And I know this is not the same thing, but I've been with this woman, and she fosters these drug babies, right? These little drug babies. And these kids, when I open the door, man, they come running up to me and they tell me they love me. Right? And I get to hold these kids. And like something is happening in my heart. I can't even begin. And I get to see these kids run around. And like, I know why my mom beat me. I get it, dude. Holy shit, man. Like, oh my God. Holy fuck. But I see it, man. I get to see, like, these little kids, and I see the ego in them, and I know they know, man, right? And it's just so interesting to see this thing come back full circle, right? And that's really what this whole process is. It's about awakening to this sense that we're all connected, and we all suffer, and we all go through this thing, and it's through suffering that we find love. There is no other way. Thanks for letting me share.
I've asked Princess to give out the chips.
All right, here we do a chip service to signify how long you've been in your recovery and to celebrate that. The first one we have is for first comers. Anybody want to celebrate coming in out of the rain? Try chips.
Thank you.
my door. It is in this bad. I need to settle the score. Twisted.